I'm Marty Moscoe-Wayne. Welcome back to Radio Times. William Giraldi loved books and words, but kept that secret when he was a kid growing up in Manville, New Jersey. He was raised in a hyper-masculine family by a single dad who loved to race high-speed motorcycles and worked with his hands. Giraldi discovered bodybuilding in his uncle's homemade gym when he was 15 years old, and he got hooked. In one summer, he transformed his body so he no longer looked like the pale, bookish, scrawny teen who got picked on in school. William Giraldi's memoir, The Hero's Body, is about that macho world, about bodybuilding, his relationship with his dad, and societal ideas about manliness. His father was killed in a motorcycle accident when he was 47 years old. He was probably going 100 miles an hour on a winding back road in Pennsylvania. Giraldi was 25 years old, and he joins us here in our Philadelphia studio. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Pleasure to be here, Marty. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Your book begins with you getting very sick with meningitis. Mm-hmm. You're taken to the hospital. Your dad has no health insurance, but he, over the next 7 years, pays $100 a month mm-hmm. to pay off that bill. It takes him something like 7 years to do that, $8,400. And I thought, what an interesting way to meet your dad, a man of his word.
Yes, he certainly was that. And when you think about the dedication, devotion, especially that word devotion, we don't use it a lot these days. But he was a man devoted to his family, his three kids. He was a single father raising us. We didn't have a mother growing up. And so I remember that devotion very well. It's ingrained in me.
You began this book, I read, and you just told me shortly after he died. I mean, or perhaps this book was working on you since then. What took so long?
The words.
Words,
I don't,
yes.
I don't mean that to sound flip. For me, the book, or any piece of writing that I do, the words are everything. That might sound obvious to listeners who aren't writers, but to get the right register, the right tone of the language, the right pitch of the language. It took 16 years to write this book because I was struggling all along to find the right language to fit the circumstances that I needed to discuss. That's a long time, I know, and it's not a long book. It's fewer than 300 pages. So what took me so long? Mm. Just trying to hone the language to have it reach into the depths that I needed.
Well, you have near the end of your book a conversation with your father where he basically says, well, he says words are easy. A person's words aren't worth blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. I mean, for him, words were not that important, or perhaps didn't have the value that they have had for you.
No, they certainly weren't. I struggle to understand in this book where that affinity for language came from, because it didn't come from him, and it certainly didn't come from my family, the Giraldi family in Manville, New Jersey.
What a perfect name for such a macho family,
I just,
right?
If I had done that in a work of fiction,
right,
people would have said, my God, what a stretch. But that's true. The town of Manville was named for the Johns Manville Corporation. They produced asbestos building supplies. And their hub, they had a giant factory right there in my hometown. I remember it well. That scene to which you're referring about my father and I in our garage. I was 15 years old, and I had just been shucked by my first girlfriend. I was just heart slapped by this. I just did not know what to do. I don't know if you remember that.
Things like that. Yes,
that first love was
heartbreaking.
It was the entire cosmos, and he did that. He brought me into the garage, and he showed me a chest full of letters that he and my mother had exchanged from the time that they were high school sweethearts. And he said that. He said, these aren't worth anything. It's your actions that count in the world. And most men will notice that mindset, that it's what you do, not what you say.
Well, even adding to that, your mother had left the family. I mean, it sounds like, I don't know if she's part of your life now at all, but she clearly had left the family, hooked up with somebody else.
She did. She abandoned my father and her three kids
Abandoned?
Yeah, it was very much abandonment. She left for another man. We didn't know that at the time. It took – of course, she was keeping it secret because she wouldn't have been entitled to any divorce settlement if that was known. And so – but it was something that became known in the years after their split. I'm not in touch with my mother now. My mother's dead. She died in 2008 an overdose of sleeping medication and alcohol. And so she's absent from this book. And I say early on that she's absent from this book because she was absent from our lives. And then I say that perhaps there will be a book about her one day if I could ever earn the necessary mercy to tell it.
And mercy for her?
Mercy for her.
Forgiving her?
I think so. And the reason is the book will be a failure if that mercy isn't attained. And I mean to say that no one wants to read an account of bitterness. It's if it's bad for you in your life, it's absolutely fatal for a writer, that bitterness. So it's been dissipating every year. I'm getting to the point where I might be able to do it.
Yeah, because I don't want to spend too much time on this, but at one point you say that either you felt or your father said that she didn't want you. I mean, you felt sort of unwanted, perhaps unloved by your mother.
Oh, that's certainly true.
So powerful. Mm. I want to have you read a section from the book with you and your dad on page 43 at the bottom. Mm.
My father and I warred all through my teenage years, verbally, physically, psychologically. The worst it ever got was a shoving contest in the upstairs hallway when I was 16. I lost. He pinned me against my bedroom door, his forearm in my throat, firm up beneath my chin, frothing a millimeter from my face, and it didn't stop until my sister, a Niagara of tears and screams, pounded our shoulders and heads with both her fists. The fault was mine. I was a canker in our home. Disobedient, disrespectful, dismissive. My father, under vigorous financial and emotional strain, still in his early 30s, felt unvalued, unloved by me. I wish I could have seen that. All adolescents can't be as swollen-headed as I was. Everyone knew that my mother had left our family because she'd met someone else, a man with money, and yet during one of our verbal shootouts, I had the callousness right there at hand. You know, I said, it's your fault she left us. It was you. I don't know what I could have meant by that. He drove her away, wasn't man enough to keep her, but I knew it would wound him, and that's what I wanted then. All I ever did was love your mother, he said. And then he rose from the front porch and walked inside. I won that one, if you can call that winning. I'd give a considerable sum to be able to change my attitude that afternoon, revise those cutting words. Like many father-son relationships, ours improved immensely once I got the hell out of the house.
That's such a powerful description. And you're not the only man I know that got into physical altercations with a father whom they loved, who they found impossible to love, who they blamed for things. In this case, it's your dad who was left behind to kind of hold the family together.
Yeah, he did more than that. It was more than just holding. It was a real excellence in fathering. And I don't mean to imply by that he was a perfect father. I mean to say that his devotion was perfect. And I began by saying – I began our conversation today by saying how rare that word is in the common parlance. Devotion, we don't hear it a lot. Is it perhaps because it's tinged with spirituality, that word? It may be religion. But it seems to me a necessary word. And he is certainly where I learned it, yeah.
Well, it's so interesting, as you say, this fierce devotion that your father had, not particularly interested in your interest in books and reading and literature. You went to a Catholic school, even felt that kind of inspiration from the gospel, I mean, the words from the Bible. Mm. You quote your dad as sort of dismissing poem. Oh, I can do a poem, Bart, laid a fart. Mm-hmm, I mean, that's he wasn't interested. He didn't know how to be interested in your interests.
I kept it secret. I knew not to. I was in the closet, as it were, with literature. It wasn't just a Giraldi thing. It was certainly a town-wide. It was a Manvillian notion that literature or any of the arts were ravingly femme, were for what they would call pansies, sissies, weaklings. These are the words that you heard, right? And I didn't have to be told that. I simply intuited it from being there, from living in this ultra-masculine household. It wasn't just my father. It was both of my uncles, my Uncle Nicky and my Uncle Tony, also my grandfather, an imperious patriarch. We called him Pop. We still do. He's still alive.
Wow.
These were men who revered wrestlers, soldiers, weightlifters, sports heroes, woodsmen, lumberjacks, and all of the masculine arts. You know what they are, from motorcycle racing to football to boxing. I simply was never in that headspace. I could not understand it. I was propelled. I felt propelled toward literature. For reasons that weren't entirely known to me.
Hmm.
But it was very clear to me now, and in writing this book, The Hero's Body, looking back to say, I was struggling to find my place in the world, as any young person will. But I had these forces that I was up against almost continuously, not to say that I was always conscious of them. But that's part of what the memoir should do. Any memoir, I think, should do is look back and try to understand the forces of which you were not entirely conscious then. And so that's what I tried to do in The Hero's Body.
Well, and I do want to talk about the bodybuilding part, because that's such an important part of this story. But did you feel you had to fake things or hide things like your love of reading and books? I mean, you were given a BB gun. You were given, you know, the kind of weapons that perhaps parents today don't want to give a 9 or 10-year-old.
That's true. Why my father gave my brother and me a BB gun and a compound hunting bow when we were barely tall enough to see over the kitchen counter is a mystery I live with.
But he did.
He did. Yes, he did.
Did he trust you with these weapons? Was that what he was saying?
He should not have.
No.
He should not have. Our babysitter got shot in the chin. The BB had to be excised from her face. We pierced our house with the bow and the arrows. It was an extraordinarily foolish thing to do. How do I explain that? Because I just said a minute ago that he was a devoted father. So why would a devoted father give his two young sons a BB gun and a compound hunting bow?
You know what? Let that question hang out there, only because we have to take a very short break. And then we will definitely pick up on that. Talking with William Giraldi in this hour of Radio Times. He's a fiction editor at Boston University, a journal called Agony, also contributing editor to The New Republic. And he's got a new book. It's a memoir called The Hero's Body. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, talking with William Giraldi, about why his father gave him a BB gun and a bow and arrow, or I guess an even more serious weapon than a bow and arrow, when he was 10 years old. Go ahead. So why did he do that?
Well, as I was saying, I think he was pushing masculine arts upon us. He was trying to signal these are masculine items, and if you're going to be a man, then you need to master them. Because you have to keep in mind that I never got any explicit berating about be a man. It was all done, I almost said covertly.
Yeah.
I mean, it was done without any obvious pressures. The pressures were always there, but they weren't spoken. It was simply through demonstration that one got the idea that one must be masculine. And so it's important for me to point that out, because my father wasn't the great Santini.
Right.
He really wasn't.
Right. And that's important, because he was an abuser, the great Santini.
Indeed he was.
You write, for the Giraldis of Manville in the late decades of the 20th century, the psychodynamics are not hard to untie. The vauntingly masculine and competitive are always trying to silence the inner whisper saying, you are not man enough. So having to prove yourself.
Indeed. Yeah, that's precisely what I mean by that passage. The vauntingly masculine are always trying to silence. It's an inner whisper. It's persistent. And it says, you're not man enough. You're not tough enough. You're not strong enough. You know, that inner whisper propels a lot of great athletes. I remember Michael Jordan. He was so competitive. And could we say the same about him? Could we say that his extreme competitiveness came from that inner whisper, persistent, saying, you're not good enough, you must prove yourself? Perhaps that leads to greatness, but not everyone's Michael Jordan. And I think for me, growing up as I did in the mid-80s in this town called Manville in central New Jersey, I needed to do these things. I needed to not just forge a spot for myself in my household, but in my town, and in, let's be honest, a nationwide masculine ethos. If you remember what the mid '80s were like,
I do.
Arnold Schwarzenegger and Rambo and Rocky and all of this, right? I think for boys who came of age in the mid '80s, the brute and bluster of Hulk Hogan and Sly Stallone as Rambo. This formed our conceptions of our own selfhood.
Well, you describe, and I want to have you read another section from the book. You mentioned your Uncle Tony. He had this, I guess, kind of homemade gym in his house. You go to this house. This is after you have meningitis, and you go to Uncle Tony's house. And let's have you read what happened there, and then we can talk about it.
Right. So about the meningitis, I'll just say I spent a month with viral meningitis. I was in the hospital for 2 weeks. I was in bed for an entire month, and it withered me down to nothing. And this is what happened. In the deadening heat of a May afternoon, stultified by sadness and boredom, I wandered over to my Uncle Tony's house and found him weightlifting in the pro-grade gym he'd installed in one half of his cobweb basement. AC/DC yawping from a set of speakers. The song, Problem Child. Tony lived across the street from my grandparents, where my father, siblings, and I ate dinner each weeknight. And so I'd known about his gym. He'd built and welded most of it himself, but never had a reason to care about it. Earnestly unjockish, I'd long considered myself the artistic sort. I kept a notebook full of dismal poems, song lyrics, and quotes from writers I wanted to remember. My hero was the reptilian rock god Axl Rose. Filthy and skinny, he looked hepatitic, and I thought I should too. But there in my uncle's basement, my sallow non-physique mocking me from a wall of cracked mirrors, I clutched onto one of the smaller barbells and strained through a round of bicep curls, aping my uncle, who for whatever reason did not laugh or chase me away. And with that barbell in my grip, with blood surging through my slender arms, entire precincts inside me popped to life. Engorged veins pressed against the skin of my small biceps, and I rolled up the sleeves of my t-shirt to see them better, to watch their pulsing in the mirror. Wordlessly, I did what my uncle did, trailed him from the barbells to the dumbbells to the pulley machine, trying to keep up, mouthing along to the boisterous lyrics. And in the 30 minutes I spent down there that first day, I had sensations of baptism or birth. Those were 30 minutes during which I'd forgotten to feel even a shard of pity for myself. I didn't know if I was lifting weights the right way, but I knew that I'd just been claimed by something holy. I'd return to his basement the following day, and the day after that, I'd return every weekday for 2 years.
And again, that's William Giraldi, our guest, reading from his book, a memoir called The Hero's Body. The precincts popping up. I mean, just all of a sudden discovering your body. I mean, you've been living in it for 15 years, but discovering something else about your body is a kind of rebirth for yourself?
Absolutely transformative. Absolutely transformative. Ovid speaks of Narcissus. It is myself I love, myself I see. The gay delusion is a part of me. This is Ovid speaking about Narcissus, but this is exactly what my bodybuilding obsession. There's no other word. Obsession evolved into. It is myself I see, myself I love. But what is one really trying to do when one is building up one's body? This is compensatory masculine conduct, by which I mean something is going on inside that is propelling this mission. And I mean mission very much.
To kind of rebuild yourself or build yourself up.
Absolutely. To formulate your own creation myth. And so I was down there lifting weights every weekday for 2 years with my uncle. We had formed a holy partnership of anguish, of pain, because this is the kind of weightlifting we did. It was brutal stuff with squats and deadlifts, very heavy weights, very intense. We didn't talk while we trained. And that obsession was an effort to live up to the masculine ethos of my family. Remember, I was growing up in a Homeric environment, by which I mean that my family's conception of masculinity was Homeric, that men were either valorous and brave and remembered, or they were weak and forgotten. And this is precisely what you see in the Iliad. You see men being portrayed in these ways, and my family subscribed to that.
I can understand the narcissism, but it also, and I, you know, who hasn't seen bodybuilders or even watched some of those competitions? And it does, in many ways, look like narcissism, but it must also be incredible. And you spent a summer essentially building or rebuilding your body to be able to witness that in yourself, to see muscles where they hadn't been before, and to be able to do things you hadn't been able to do before.
To be able to discover myself. I mean, what you said earlier about coming into my body. I mean, I had gone 15 years without actually feeling my body. And this was revolutionary for my conception of my own selfhood, that all of a sudden you could feel yourself on the earth because you had heft, you had strength, you had a solidity, a rotundity and solidity to your body. And that was absolutely pivotal for a vulnerable 15-year-old psyche.
Was it also, or is it also, a kind of suit of armor, a way of protecting yourself by building up this amazing physique?
I didn't see it that way at the time, but I certainly see it that way now. I don't think that any young kid achieves the metamorphosis that I achieved without feeling an extreme sense of vulnerability, without feeling that there are somewhere, somehow, missiles aimed at him, without feeling that this is a carnivorous world that is out to devour him. I know I felt that way. Mm-hmm. And I can't speak for every male who achieves the kind of body armor that I achieved when I was a teenager, but I'm willing to bet that they feel very much the way I did.
You describe after this summer where you really transformed your body. There was a student, a girl at your school, you call her V. Mm. She took one look at you and she just said, whoa.
She said, whoa. Because she had been seeing me all along as a twiggy kid. And then
did that feel good though?
Good. Did it feel good? She invited me into her bedroom, Marty. I mean, felt.
I don't want to have too many leading questions.
I know
here.
It felt more than good. It was. It felt holy. It felt like being welcomed into an altar. I'll never forget her bedroom. It was the first female bedroom that I had ever really spent any time in, and to spend that kind of time with her. Remember, I had been looking at her for all throughout my childhood. She was this beautiful older girl, and she was really super cool, you know, super cool. And for her to notice me like that, but not just notice, invite me back into her room and to spend that time with me there was There's no other word but holy, and I've never forgotten
what word you were going to use.
There's no other word but holy. It was that kind of experience for me.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's William Giraldi, our guest. We're talking about his memoir. It's called The Hero's Body. It's about his father, and we'll get back to his father. Also about his obsession with bodybuilding. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. Also, this hyper masculine environment that he grew up in Manville, of all places, in Manville, New Jersey. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I wonder, too, and you spend a lot of the book, you know, describing all the various exercises you did and your calves and your legs, whether when you have that kind of a physique, just how differently you walk, how differently you carry yourself.
Oh, I didn't walk. I waddled.
Oh, you waddled. You had
waddled.
So much.
My wife says I still walk like that, even though I don't have the muscles anymore. I hope she's wrong about that. You know, to feel those muscles in your step and to feel that heft, to feel fortified in that way, I could not imagine how I had gone so long without it.
Interesting.
And I could not fathom how other people who are unmuscled got through the world without that heft in their step, without that swagger that you're talking about. Because it's true that bodybuilders don't just walk. They strut.
Right.
They can't help it, really. And it is not just that they can't help it. They quite like it. I did. I liked that strut, that swagger, that waddle. I was heavy with muscle. And that walk was a signal of your election. It was a signal of what you had accomplished, the arduousness that you endure in order to look like that, because it's not easy to look like that. Remember, your body doesn't want to look like that. You've got to push it to those extremes.
Your dad saw your body and he said, "Oh, you know, you look like Hercules." But then his dad, Pop, kind of dressed him down, saying, "Well, you were never very good at this bodybuilding stuff."
That's right. My father, remember, the bodybuilding patriarch of my family was my grandfather, was Pop. And he growing up in the early 40s, he was a wrestler and a bodybuilder, a weightlifter. This was at a time when bodybuilding was not as well known as it is today. But when my Uncle Tony began weightlifting, he did so in conscious emulation of Pop. Pop was a big guy, muscled, heavy. He peacocked through the world, roostered through the world. And my father, although my father was a good wrestler and he was a skilled carpenter and he was very good on a motorcycle, my father never had the kind of devotion that Pop and Tony, his brother and his father, that they had. Or that I had.
Yeah.
He didn't take to it, or maybe I should say it didn't take to him. And so when he poked fun at me that night that you're talking about, that scene in the book, Pop really blasted him. It really stood up for me. It was really the only time that Pop was interested in me, let's say, at least to that extent, was when I was weightlifting.
You talk about getting into steroids, almost like fetishizing your bag of steroids. Mm. And you also talk about words. You talked about aching for steroids. Mm. Just what feeling like this can take me to this next level that I just can't get to without them.
Yeah, I began training at I was about to turn 16, and from about 16 to 18, I trained as hard as I could without drugs. And there's a wretched thing that happens to the body. We call it the plateau. You stop making gains. And not only do you stop making gains, but you actually slip. You slide back.
Your body almost fighting you?
You're training just as hard and you're eating just as much. You're just as maniacal. But you've stopped making gains, and it's an absolute annihilation on your ego. I remember that feeling. I'm 16, 17, 18 years old. These muscles they're my identity. Not just identity, and that word identity is jostled about so much these days. I mean it to mean something much deeper than identity. I mean to say I mean to say it was part of what I imagined spirit to be, right? And this was something that I picked up from from the ancient Greeks, for them, the exterior was a manifestation of the interior. And so when you look at those the artwork of depicting Achilles or Odysseus or Ajax or Hercules, not only are they muscled, strong and big, but they're valorous and they're brave and they're cunning and they're intelligent. So for me, there was a connection there. Our society, thanks in large part to Christianity, no longer sees that. We no longer see a connection between the exterior and the interior.
But at the same time, as you write, and it's true about taking steroids, there are the side effects. We're talking about high blood pressure. We're talking about horrible-sounding headaches, as you describe, puffy faces, acne, irritability, breasts. I mean, all of – but it was still worth it to have the steroids in spite of all these side effects?
Worthwhile consequences to live up to the Western ideal of masculinity and machismo. Yeah, I think so. Also, keep in mind when you're 18, you think you're going to live forever.
Right.
And my experience of myself at 18, but also knowing other 18-year-olds, was that you're not thinking about your future health. It's simply inconceivable to you that you're ever going to be harmed or that you're certainly that you're going to die. I was on drugs for about a year and a half. I never took very many of them. And I never took them as long as other bodybuilders did. But they were an absolute necessity if you wanted to reach the place I needed to be.
Which was to be able to compete.
Was to be able to compete, absolutely.
Well, let's take another short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Again, William Giraldi is our guest in this hour of Radio Times. He's a contributing editor to The New Republic. He's also a fiction editor for a journal called Agni at Boston University. Grew up in Manville, New Jersey, just outside of Princeton. And he's written a book, a memoir called The Hero's Body, both about himself, clearly, and also about his dad, who died driving his motorcycle 100 miles an hour in Pennsylvania. We'll be talking about that as well. 1-888-477-9499, Radio Times at WHYY.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and we'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, and we are learning about the macho male culture that dominated our guest's life growing up in Manville, New Jersey. And again, the book is called The Hero's Body. You did finally get to compete. And along the way, and this I've seen again, bodybuilders are so interesting. I mean, on the one hand, I have to say I find it really disturbing. I can't also not look at a body like that, male or female, because you just wonder how did they do that. But often for the men, I'm sure for the women as well, we're talking about a really entirely shaved body.
Oh yeah.
I mean, no hair, no fur whatsoever.
No.
To show off the muscles?
Well, yeah, you can't fight so hard to have those muscle striations and the separation between muscle and then cover them up with hair, Marty. That
just doesn't work,
That just
right?
doesn't work. You fought long and hard for those. They're called cuts. But you say, oh, he's cut is how it's described. But really what you're doing is you're through diet and exercise, you're allowing the muscle to separate from other muscles, so it almost leaps out, distinct and hard, and you want to be able to see the ridges between muscles, and also the muscle striation, how the muscle, the bands and the ribbons of the muscle. Remember, your muscle is this fibrous thing; it's not just a clump. So, to be able to show that. Is a necessity, absolutely. And not just for bodybuilders on the stage, but guys in the gym do this as well. They'll shave their arms, they'll shave their legs.
I'm looking at your arms now.
Yeah, no, I've
hairy arms.
No, I don't do that anymore. I'm 20 years removed from this lifestyle, but I'll tell you, I've never lost my reverence for it. And I've got to say too, and I don't know if this will strike you as strange, but I miss it.
No, I understand that. I mean, this was your life for 3 years.
But there was a camaraderie and brotherhood involved in what we were doing that I don't have now. That was really important to me. We had a real brotherhood of the body.
Yeah.
And important friendships. And I think about those guys a lot.
And a different kind of friendship that you might have with a man who's not a bodybuilder? I mean, was it in many ways about the body?
I can say at that time I did have friends who weren't bodybuilders. Remember, I was keeping my literary life secret. And so I had friends who were writers and friends who were readers. And as you can imagine, they were just baffled by how I looked.
Two different worlds, right?
Yeah, they were baffled by it. I eventually became baffled by it as well. I mean, I lasted only 3 years in this world. And
you did compete.
I did. I competed twice.
You did pretty well.
I did pretty well the first time. I took second out of 8, I think. And the second time, I had already left it in my heart, I suppose one would say. I'd left it in my spirit by the time I competed the second time. And I was done. I didn't do well. I was suffering a terrible bout of melancholy at the time. I was suffering through another breakup, and my father had sold our boyhood home, and I was living by myself, and I was terribly depressed at the time of my second show, and didn't do well at all.
You're obviously an older person now. I mean, how much do you think yeah. about? And we all know what happens mm-hmm. to our bodies when we get older. But yes.
Oh God.
So how do you think about your body, or how do you even look at your body, or do you?
I try not to look at it now. I have no choice but to feel it now. I have three young boys, and the oldest is 7, and the middle child is 4, and they use me daily as a wrestling mat. And so every morning I wake up with aches and pains that weren't there when I went to sleep. And I have no memory.
Inflicted during the night time?
I mean, inflicted the previous day that I hadn't realized that they had hurt me by stomping on me or jumping on me. Or they're constantly bike riding and skateboarding and pogo sticking. And it's something to keep up with them, I'll tell you.
No BB guns in your house, though?
No. God, no. No, my wife, no, no, no.
But do you think – I don't want to make too much of it, but do you think having this, for lack of a better word, this kind of macho culture where you did have a BB gun and you were out perhaps in the woods and sort of being that hunter warrior. Parents are so protective of their kids now. Do you think something is lost?
Well, that's a tough question. I know that I don't regret any of the ways my father brought me up. And I wouldn't change any of it. Then you can ask, then why aren't you bringing up your boys the same way, if that's true? Well, as you say, we live it in a different kind of consciousness now. We're much more careful. I think we're smarter about things. Is the world, by and large, a better place now than it was when I was growing up, when I was a child in the 1980s? I'm not an expert on that. I have a feeling that we're much more aware now. And it's not to say that we're not bombarded with problems every hour of every day, because we are. But I think when it comes to these ideas of masculinity and machismo and the raising of boys, I think we're in a better place. At least I can speak only for myself. And I don't want my kids on motorized vehicles. I don't want them having guns and knives, even if they're BB guns and you say they're harmless. I'm not judging the guy who wants to do that with his kids. But remember, we live in the city of Boston, and that's not the culture there.
Yeah.
If you're growing up, say, in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, Marty, then perhaps those firearms and those bows and arrows are part of your life there. And that's for you to decide. For me, where we are, I don't want it.
Let me read a couple of comments. And I do want to talk about your dad. An email from Paul says, what about team sports, the shared winning and losing camaraderie? Was that something that was missing? I mean, when you were a kid, did you play soccer or baseball or, you know, the kind of team sports that
– I was a failure at them. I tried baseball. I failed. I tried basketball. I failed. I'm much – I mean, have you seen me? I'm 5'8". I can't play basketball. And so, no, the bodybuilder is a kind of isolado. Remember, this is Melville's term in Moby Dick, an isolado. And the camaraderie comes from being with the other guys who are doing the same thing. It's not a team sport, I understand, but but the brotherhood there is absolutely essential. I don't think I would have done it for as long as I did, for 3 years, from the ages of 16 to 19, if it hadn't been for that camaraderie, which, by the way, is the same reason my father rode those motorcycles as fast as he did every Sunday. It was the brotherhood that was more important than the actual bike.
Interesting. Let me read a comment from Bertha Paoli saying, I'm amazed at the language you, William, are using. His description and choice of words are refreshing.
Mm. Wow, that's nice to hear. Thank you so much.
You mentioned your dad and these. It wasn't just, you know, a big fat Harley Davidson or some Davidson or something. These were fast bikes.
Yeah, they're called a sport bike or a super sport bike. They aren't the easy riders that you're talking about.
These
are the fastest that a human being could go and still be on the ground. Absolutely deific machines, these motorcycles. My father was killed on a motorcycle called a Yamaha R1, a YZF R1. And at the time of his death, it was one of the fastest, if not the fastest bike you could buy legally.
Wow.
And of course, my father and his cohort, they all modified the bikes to go faster than they were supposed to, which was pretty fast to begin with. I don't know if this is going to strike you as strange or strike your listeners as strange, but I look at those bikes and I don't feel any kind of horror because my father was killed on one. I look at them now and I get a little...
You feel that tingle?
I do. I feel... I've never ridden... And I wouldn't ride, but when I see someone on one and I see that he knows what he's doing, it's pretty titillating for me. My uncle Nicky, my father's youngest brother, is still a motorcycle racer. The difference now is that he does it on a track, a closed track, because the road, when you're riding on the road, when there are trees and other immovable objects, you don't want to hit those at 100 miles an hour. That's how you don't walk away. That's what happened to my father.
Yeah.
On a racetrack, there's nothing to hit. And that's how you're able to walk away if you go down. And so I'm still very much living through my Uncle Nicky. I'm still very much living in this motorcycle headspace.
Well, your dad, and I guess when you're riding or driving a motorcycle 100 and some miles an hour, you're going to have accidents. So he certainly, before the fatal one, had... What, numerous accidents, right?
Numerous. One that snapped his collarbone in two places. That happened about a year before his fatal crash. And there was one other minor one. Absolutely, my father and my grandfather and my uncles were attending funerals all the time.
Really?
Because members of their cohort would get killed on a Sunday ride. One of my father's mentors, motorcycle riding mentors, a man named Kurt, was killed when he collided into a tree. It was the only time I've ever seen my father weep.
You talk about a, quote, suicidal cult of speed.
A suicidal cult of speed, yes.
You think there was something, if not death-defying, somehow death-embracing as well?
I don't see how I can deny that. It's not something I was aware of at the time, and it's not something that I think my father was conscious of. But how else do we talk about men who achieve those speeds when they know what can happen, and not just can happen but will happen? How else do we make sense of that except to say that there is a powerful unconscious need for that kind of danger? And remember, this is how men prove themselves, right? Whether it's on a football field or on a motorcycle, you're proving yourself through your masculine abilities. How fast can you go? How big can you get? How strong can you be? Because it is only then that you are really worth something.
When
really,
you feel like a man.
When you feel worthy of manhood, let us say.
Your dad died on May 7th, 2000. Interestingly, he was going to get married again.
He was about to be married.
Yeah. So, I mean, when you piece all that together, and you spend a fair amount of the book sort of looking at what happened and looking at reports from the scene of the accident to try to figure out how did this happen to my dad, especially on this day.
Yeah, May 7th. It was just a few days before my 26th birthday. In fact, we buried my father on my birthday, and I have a part in the book where I talk about what it feels like to bury your father on the day of your birth. And I think the wording I use is to bury your father on the day of your birth is to become truly born. And I was stealing from Freud a little bit there, and I think I meant that I would have to become my father, that now that my father was no longer here, that I would have to assume his characteristics, whether if that was a devoted father or someone with his particular attitudes towards the world.
I'd love to have you read another section from the book, and this is on page 188, and this is about your father and speed.
All of our lives are set by a certain terrible inevitability, causality ruled by the forces of speed and momentum, energy and force. Those superbikes and the way my father's clan rode them took that fact and boiled it down to its most brutal and thrilling essence. They demonstrated the perhaps uniquely male quality of submitting to the insane, the great, and the deadly, almost exclusively within the dynamic of a group, a setting in which, on Sunday afternoons, time collapsed into itself at excessive speeds, in which social rules melted away and were replaced by Homeric codes. The brotherhood, exaltation, and worship my father found on Sunday rides was no different from the brotherhood, exaltation, and worship I found training at the physical edge. After a certain age, wrote Proust, the more one becomes oneself, the more obvious one's family traits become. My father and I were not as far apart as I sometimes pretend. We both had the unignorable impulse to extremity, an impulse passed down from Pop.
I really like that section. You were interviewed, we're almost out of time here, interviewed in the Boston Globe?
Yes.
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 And one of the things you said in there was that it took you a while to write this book, that you were almost ashamed of writing about masculinity.
I was ashamed of writing about masculinity. I was ashamed of writing about my own body looking like this. When you're a young writer, you want to be taken seriously. And this didn't seem to me to be a serious literary subject. It's easy to mock, isn't it? Many people do. When they see bodybuilders, they don't feel any admiration for the devotion, the dedication that it took, the religious devotion it took to look that way. They are full of ridicule and scorn, the nothingness of scorn and noise, as John Clare, the poet John Clare, says. And so I felt that too. I wanted to be taken seriously and to write about serious literary themes. And it took the birth of my sons to realize that this material that I'm writing about in The Hero's Body, in this memoir, is nothing to be ashamed of. I need to explore it for their sake.
Well, I would agree with you on that. William Giraldi, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. The book is called The Hero's Body. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program, including how to download a podcast of the show. Nick Kowalski helping us out today. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. And the show is produced by Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, John Ahrens, and Liz Fiedler. I'm Marty Moscoe, and thank you so much for joining us.